wall to keep us free. That's why we build a wall. We build a wall to keep us free. We build a wall to keep us free.
And that was Building a Wall by Anais Mitchell. Now, to broaden out our consideration and look at physical health as well as mental health, I thought we would have a section. This is from part 4 of The Corruption of Christianity. It's a series of audio programs produced by journalist David Cayley for CBC Canada, and it was first broadcast in the year 2000.
The feeling for just proportions, for what fit, Ivan Illich has argued, was a physical sense, a real perceptual ability that people once had. The world of values, therefore, deprives us not just of the idea of the good, but imposes an actual sensual deprivation. Illich sees an example of this deprivation in the way contemporary people experience their own bodies. Until well into the 18th century, he says, the body was felt to be a microcosm. There was a correspondence between the individual body and nature as a whole. According to a tradition which descended from the Roman physician Galen, the body was thought to be composed of 4 humors, and health was conceived in terms of the balance of these cosmic elements, as they flowed or were blocked within the body. Illich has studied this humoral, microcosmic body by observing the way it conditioned the encounter between physicians and their patients. The doctor, in this old tradition, he says, could do no more than support and foster the body's tendency to return to a balanced state. Unlike the contemporary doctor, who determines his patient's experience by his diagnosis, these older doctors had to rely on the patient's own report.
When I look at doctors, when I have 5 or 6 good studies which do this, on how they behave when they meet a patient, before modern medicine has trained them to a modern self-consciousness, the doctor, they listen to the patient. I am tired of hearing, well, a good modern doctor does it too. Let him do it in 7 minutes and a half. He listens to the patient's story. He makes an anamnesis, which is the patient's self-awareness, which is pretty credible because usually it takes the form of complaints. The patient comes with complaint. He comes to cry on the doctor's shoulder. And when I analyze what the patients told the doctor, it is about how they feel. How they feel, I don't have to say in old English how they feel themselves. So this, if I ask you how do you feel, even in modern English, how do you sit in yourself? How is it today? How is that who you are? First of all, to his own seat and stance, and second, to the world around him. What the doctor treated was what he got through the confession of the patient. You know, my right eye gives out since I saw that man being hanged. It's a very common thing, and I'm blind on my right eye, although sometimes I see. And I think of a very concrete one. Since my landlord, who is a powerful man, threw me out of the house in a most uncivilized way, I have enormous pains because I feel that my juices don't run down my left leg anymore. I could go on telling dozens, hundreds of such stories. And the doctor does not only hear what the patient says, but he also immediately qualifies what kind of a character in the humoral, today we would almost say astrological sense, he doesn't have to know any explicit astrology, this is. This sanguine man reports on a blockage of his red flows to the tips of his toes on the left side, and then translates this into much more detailed, specific, beautiful Latin language which we call Galenic medicine, which is learned in school. So a doctor's task consists is essentially an interpretative one. It's an exegesis of what the patient reveals about himself, with the competence to translate this into explicit medical knowledge, which is so clear that it immediately makes him see internally the plants, which are related to the same issue. Plants, at least in our Western post-medieval medical manuals, are classified by organs, by human organs. The little man who stands in the middle of the classification miniature relates the organ, the liver, to that plant, and the stomach to that other plant, and here assemble bouquets of plants and flowers, and sometimes even animals, which a doctor immediately thinks of. So the doctor translates the story about the humoral, the flowing experience, or stopping experience, the cold and the warm of the flows, the biting nastiness of some, and the sweetness which is overwhelming and takes away his good judgment when he sees that woman's face, into scientific language, his science, which relates to possible other cosmic elements which might, and that he must know, help under these circumstances.
Two things stand out for Illich in this encounter of doctor and patient. First, that the patient tells a story which locates whatever discomfort he is feeling in the context of his entire experience. And second, that the doctor attends to this experience rather than to some construct which his superior knowledge allows him to impose on it. He relies on the patient's word.
All traditional doctors believed in people, their patients, telling them about their nature. Nature was experienced, was felt, was smelled, was tasted by people. And the physician, as if he were participating in a Greek tragedy, through mimesis, sympathy which becomes feeling the other, was trained, like the spectator in the Greek theater, to feel the actor, to feel this tragic instance of an individual sitting in front of him who had been caught in his human condition in some mess, in something contrary, and nature was trying to heal itself. The idea of health didn't exist, but only of nature being more or less capable to constantly heal itself. And what he did as a doctor was, through counsel, through sympathy, through the power of the word, the healing word, and perhaps through ground corals or mercury pills, which are highly poisonous, as we would say today, to encourage nature, to reinforce nature, to perform its own healing act. Today we can hardly think that way about what the function of a doctor is. We always think that he uses some tool of his profession to do something to the system of a subsystem in the patients which he knows about, not the patient.
What is significant about this change for Illich is the way in which it undermines and brackets the patient's experience of his own flesh. His condition is no longer something that he can feel, but something he has to be told about. In the terms Illich developed earlier, there is no longer a fit. The body has lost its correspondence with other elements in the cosmos and become a set of values which the doctor alone is qualified to read and interpret.
If I think of a medical encounter today, it usually has a certain shape, unthinkable until my generation. I call up the doctor and say, "Doctor, I feel terribly tired." "Well, Mr. Illich, take a pencil. You go to the lab and have a blood test of such type, and urine test of such type, and excrements of such type, and when you come here, and my assistant will make, because you're an old man by now, a cardiogram, and let's hope he stops there. And when I look at that and tell you what's happening with your body, and if he's a very well-trained, modern doctor, he'll say, and further, I'll give you a few direct and indirect psychological tests, what happens with you, because you are not a body only, you are a psychophysical being. From earliest childhood on, it is in this way that we are trained, or our mothers are trained, to think about what we are made of, what the stuff is which sits there and smiles or sighs. Nothing of this I can find in 800 years of history of the medical encounter. The one thing the doctor wants to know from a patient, that he tell him stories. He doesn't have to solicit them, because the patient will begin and say, you know, doctor, I am so terribly tired, and I knew that this would be coming. Now I'm a 70-year-old man. Once, when I was a boy and walked along that cemetery wall during the night, and that's afterwards for the first time that I felt this, and to say the truth, I'm completely sandy, washed out, dry. I can't connect now when I speak to you with my bowels. It's very difficult. I have to ask to bring me a second or third cup of coffee, or something even better than coffee. That is, the doctor, as we suggested yesterday, had to learn to accept that the flesh was summed up in the experience of it, in the experience of materiality, in the experience of stuff, in the stuffiness, the gestalt, the shape of the stuffiness of the guy sitting in front of him, which he, through hearing the story and watching the man, his behavior, language, gestures, way of sitting, diet, could grasp. This sense of the body, which is totally that to which the word ego, I, points. That which I make present in a conversation, when I say to you, I believe, that body, during the last 50 years, in my opinion, has been profoundly obscured. The ability of perceiving it, maligned. The arrests of availability of it, transformed into symptoms which a doctor, if he's a good specialist, somewhere on the border of psychology, can classify.
Now we conclude the show with the following interview from September 2014. This is Doug Henwood from Behind the News.
And now Rebecca Tiger. Tiger is an assistant professor of sociology at Middlebury College in Vermont, who specializes in, as she puts it, the intersection of punishment, social control, critical addiction studies, and media culture. Her first book, Judging Addicts, Drug Courts, and Coercion in the Justice System, was published by NYU Press in 2012. By looking closely at specialized drug courts, which were set up as some kind of alternative to conventional criminal justice for drug-related offenses, she analyzes the way we construct addiction as a disease and use therapy as a medicalized form of punishment. As she puts it in her summary of the book, rather than reforming the failures of the war on drugs, these courts permit increased social control of defendants in the name of healing and punishing them. Tiger's current work focuses on how the media aid in constructing the category of addiction, especially via celebrity drug problems. Before we get to our discussion of drug courts and celebrities, we spend some time talking about the history of official punishment in the U.S. Rebecca Tiger. Welcome, Rebecca. Let's talk first about some of the history of punishment.
Yeah.
And let's talk about a bit about the Quakers and mm-hmm. their idea of, they gave us the penitentiary, right?
Yeah.
Penitence.
Mm-hmm.
What was their thinking?
I think the thing that's important to remember about prison, that's I think a key part of its history, is that it was considered a humane reform. And so now, right, we see prison as this sort of terrible place where we warehouse people, right? Human warehousing, that's the expression. But the idea of the Quakers, and it was really sort of this model that was emerging, and I can speak about it mostly in the U.S., although the U.S. was a lot of these trends were happening in Europe too, was that the idea was that you don't publicly flog someone, you don't mutilate them, you don't, you know, nail their ear to a tree and let them starve to death publicly. That emerging theories about the body started to sort of turn people off of those kinds of punishments. And often what would happen is that instead of inciting people to behave well when they saw these public displays of sort of bodily mortification, they actually started to identify with the person being publicly humiliated and against the punishers. And so that it was loot, right? There were a number of factors that this kind of public scaffold, you know, mutilating people, that form of punishment, banishment, these things were starting to go out of favor. So the idea was that an enlightened approach was prison. And there were really two main models in the U.S. And so the Quakers gave the sort of the solitary confinement model. And the idea was that, you know, you're penitent. You sit, you think about what you've done, and after a certain period of time, because you have this solitude, you'll come back to society reformed. And you were given that time alone to think. And that this was considered really a humane way of treating people, much better than mutilating them, beating them, banishing them, whatever else might be a form of punishment. And if you go through, I've been reading the history of sort of very early forms of punishment in the U.S., and they're, you know, break someone's arm, tie them to a tree, make them starve to death. I mean, and usually they got heaped on in this, so it's not, you know, eventually you're going to die, but you're going to go through all these other things in the process. So prison was considered humane. The second model, which is the model that really came to dominate, was the behavioral model, which the idea was that actually it's a congregate model. So people should be in prison together, but in an extremely disciplined way. So often it was silence, and silence was a big part of this. But they would work together in groups, or be in groups. And the idea was that it was less about transforming the person's soul. So that was the sort of Quaker model, right? And this is the Foucault sort of thing, right? It's about transforming their soul. They're alone. They think about things. They really transform themselves. The behavioral model was less about inward transformation, but more so about external outward conformity. And so there were these two competing models. Both were sort of, you know, ways to think about both punishing someone, but also reforming them and getting them sort of ready to come back out. Because another thing that was true back then that's not true now, I mean, we have now life in prison or death in prison sentences, they get called. And there's actually a really interesting edited volume I'll tell you about at some point about the rise of life in prison sentences, which some people argue is because of death penalty advocates. So we'll get rid of death penalty, but now we'll give people sentences of 200-300 years in prison. So they're eventually going to die there. But that extremely long time in prison is new. And so the idea was that something had to happen in this institution to transform people so that they could come out and follow rules. That was the sort of idea of prison, but really the idea was that it was going to be humane. This was humane, progressive, enlightened. It was relying on the emerging sciences about the body, medicine.
And these were transformations that occurred during the progressive years?
So there's a couple of waves of thinking about people and what it means to be a person, right, what we are. So part of this is, you know, prison was this emerging idea that, again, this kind of mortification of the body, this public mortification, wasn't serving its purpose anymore. The second thing that is also happening around the same time is that the U.S., right, it's expanding so that, you know, you could shame people when it was a small community and they could be shamed in front of their neighbors, friends, their community, right? You banish them from their community. Well, that's really powerful because that's the place they have. In a small kind of homogenous community, those things worked. But as society grows, it gets more diverse. These ties people have that are personal don't exist as much. Then it's shame is harder to institute as a kind of punishment, especially this public shame. And so at this time you have medicine sort of emerging, and this idea that there's some sort of sanctity to the body, right? That it's just not that kind of treatment of the body isn't keeping in line with the emerging discovery of the body as something that should be treated in particular kinds of ways and could be healed. So medicine's a part of this story. What happens in the progressive era is something different. So the prison, right, the prison is formed, and David Rothman has written great histories of it. But, you know, almost as soon as prisons are formed, then you have the reality of them, which is you've got people locked up in these conditions. You've got brutal people overseeing them. not unlike what we have now, right? And people aren't going to be reformed in a place like that. It's just, it's kind of barbaric. So, you know, visitors to Tocqueville, other people, Dickens, you know, come to visit prisons in the U.S. And they have some really great writings about sort of what they saw, which was this complete degradation. This wasn't meeting any of the sort of models and ideals that the reformers had set up. And this is, you know, David Rothman's an historian of punishment, and he has this argument. He calls his book Conscience and Convenience. So conscience propels reform, right? We have to treat people better. Let's put them in prison. And it's hard now to see that as reform, but that was the origins. And then convenience is that it's much more expedient to treat people barbarically and inhumanely in these institutions, because that's the only way really to manage them. And Irving Goffman, who's a famous sociologist, has written about, he has a piece called On the Nature of Total Institutions, where he sort of studies what happens in total institutions. And usually it becomes a kind of dehumanizing experience. So then what happens is you have the progressive era reformers. And I'm skipping over, you know, these aren't such neat histories. There's a lot of overlapping. So you see...
Simplified for radio.
Okay, I'll simplify it. I mean, one of the ideas with prison was a sort of uniform treatment of offender, of you know, and even the concept of offender is somewhat relatively new, but it's a uniform treatment of people who misbehaved. We'll put them in solitary, or we'll put them in a congregate facility, but we're going to put them in this institution. This is the right thing to do. Well, all of a sudden you have a number of histories coming together. You have the development of psychology, you have social work sort of emerging, you've got medicine trying to stake its claim over things. And so then you have this notion that people shouldn't be treated in a uniform way. There should actually be some way to take into account all these other factors. And this is this kind of liberal, right, enlightened invention, was that, you know, people have psychological problems. There's an environmental cause for their deviant behavior. We want to delve into them in that way. And so what emerges are these progressive era courts, the juvenile courts, which I write about in my book, morals courts, the courts around sort of, right, prostitution, that the idea...
And this is also around the time when Henry Ford was, like, looking into the private lives of his employees,
yes,
too,
yes.
Right?
So basically the idea was that the court was going to heal people and punish them. And they were going to do that through this kind of intervention in people's lives that involved social workers, that involved psychology, that involved medicine, that involved these kind of developing sciences, behavioral sciences, social sciences. Sociology is part of this story, too. So sociology comes in and says, oh, it's the ghetto, you know, that turns people bad. And sociology is still doing that for us.
And I'm guessing the concept of deviance itself wasn't really thought critically about.
It wasn't thought critically about. Do you mean sort of in terms of what gets called deviance?
Yes.
Yeah. No, and I would say it's not.
That becomes self-evident. What is?
Oh, yeah, it becomes self-evident. I would say we still have that. In my book, I take the concept of addiction because I think it's a really helpful one. There's a lot of, I mean, for me, actually, what was helpful is looking at both the history of the development of the juvenile delinquent, right, which was an invention of the progressive era. Childhood is very complicated in this period of time because a notion of child is emerging, and that's historically kind of specific. And in some ways, that's being undone now. Who gets to be a child? And what does it mean to sort of have the privilege of being called a child?
But then also addicts are constructed as children,
yes,
sometimes, right?
Yeah, and so that's why in my book, I spend a fair amount of time talking about the juvenile courts, because that's really the precursor to what we have now, which is the drug courts, coerced drug treatment for people who are identified as addicts. And, you know, the idea was that there's a group of people who aren't competent. You know, we can't really consider them legally competent. And so the courts need to come in and take care of them, but it's for their own good. And so there's a team of people who are involved, and the idea is that we're going to use whatever theory we have at the time about addiction or juveniles or juvenile delinquency to cure these people.
Yeah, now let's talk some about this concept of addiction. I mean, it just seems like it's spreading all over.
Sure.
And it's used very promiscuously as a metaphor for so
mm-hmm.
many things. Our dependence on oil or
mm-hmm.
The internet,
yeah.
or sex addicts. I mean, there are all
chocolate,
these
chocolate, food, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. What is the history of this concept of addiction, and how has it spread so far?
I really appreciate that you called it a metaphor for something, because that's how in my work and when I teach about this, I really try to see addiction as expressing some underlying anxiety we have about control, about the body, about the good society that's getting grafted onto this idea that's increasingly, right, it's a brain disease, But I always push and sort of say, well, what's the it? If you actually start to pin people down, well, what's addiction? It gets very complicated. And I think
that's obvious, right?
Yeah.
I mean, these things are considered common sense, self-evident.
Well, self-evident. We've all diagnosed someone as an addict. Maybe we've diagnosed ourselves an addict. I have students who will say, well, all of us are going to face an addiction issue at some point. That's just what it means to be human, which is an interesting way for young people to think of themselves. So where does this idea emerge from? Again, this is sort of the same time period. This is sort of, you know, Benjamin Rush is one of the founding people of what's emerged as modern ways of thinking about addiction, thinking that there is such a thing as addiction and that addiction is this particular kind of disorder that's a particular kind of threat to society and has to be rooted out. And the way it has to be rooted out is through some kind of intervention that results in abstinence.
Yeah, and this word is applied to, even if we're just talking about drug addiction, mm-hmm. they're all different kinds of drugs with very different pharmacological mm-hmm. effects, yet they're treated as a single syndrome.
They're treated as a single syndrome, yeah. You know, it's an interesting thing if you push back and question these things. In the U.S., there's a lot of hostility to questioning it. Because progress is getting us to see addiction as a real thing that people need help for. So if you start to push back, and Stanton Peale is someone, I don't know if you know his work, he's very, very critical of what he calls the treatment industrial complex and the whole sort of addiction ideology. But if you start pushing back, people get really angry because basically what we sort of have is a model, and this is what I talk about in my book. Is it a disease or is it a moral failing? Well, it's better to call it a disease than a moral failing. But my argument is what we actually do is we do see diseases as moral failings, especially a disease like addiction. And all these things should be in quotes.
Yeah, and at the same time, it is something that is beyond one's control, this mm-hmm. addiction. It's a brain disease or, mm-hmm. or whatever, or it's possession by Satan almost mm-hmm. in some kind of modern scientific
yeah.
sense. At the same time, through some enormous power of will, we're supposed to triumph
yep.
over it.
That's the fundamental issue with addiction, is that it's addiction the way we've constructed it. I mean, it's complicated. So the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which is the sort of they have a budget over $1 billion. They fund something like, I don't know if this percentage is exactly right, but around 87% of the research on addiction. So not surprisingly, most of that research is going to go, you know, in that sort of neuroscience direction. In 1997, their head at that time, Alan Leshner, said, addictions, it's like your brain gets hijacked. And people love this concept, the hijacked brain. And I mean, to me now, I think it's, you know, it's a nice parallel to terrorism. And what do? We try to root it out by any means necessary.
But it's just one of these figurative master narratives that really, like, how do you get that down to the molecular level?
Well, you don't. I mean, the thing is, in some ways, you can't. I talk with my students a lot about this. I basically say to them that, you know, you can't see addiction. You can't see it because it's a cultural concept. It's a metaphor. You can't see it. But there's all these attempts to try. And so what NIDA will do is they'll show you these brain images. Oh, here's, look, the brain's been affected by drugs. But our brain, I mean, right now, lots of things are happening in my brain. But I'm not addicted to, we wouldn't say I'm addicted to talking about my book. I mean, maybe someone might say that.
But that's a healthy addiction.
It's a healthy addiction. Or exercise, right? It's like,
yeah.
And then you get into sort of like, which ones are good and which ones are bad. Oh, I'm so addicted to running. People don't say that with shame. But ultimately, I think the brain stuff isn't going to, I think it's extremely powerful, but it's not going to pan out. I don't think it's going to offer what they're claiming it can offer because there's no there. But it's still a powerful way of thinking about it. And to come back to what you said about the brain, the reason addiction is still has this taint of moral failing is that you gave into this deviant impulse within you. You gave into it. If you just didn't start using drugs, even though you might have a propensity towards it located somewhere in your brain, you wouldn't be addiction in action. And so ultimately you were weak. Even though we might later say you're sick, ultimately there was something about you, your character. I mean, and that's essentially right. And so what NIDA's done is they're trying to move from saying addiction, you can see its effects on the brain. They actually want to say, we think its origins are there, which is essentially saying addicts are fundamentally defective, which is an idea that emerged around the historian Carolyn Acker's written a really good book called Creating the American Junkie, which was about this sort of emergence in, you know, 1910, 1920 of a particular way of thinking about opiate dependence. And really, she said, there emerged these two ways of thinking about addiction. You have the irredeemably deviant addict, the street junkie, and then you have the person who becomes dependent because they went to the doctor and got their medicine, and that medicine led to dependence. So one's innocent, one's guilty, and you see that completely now in the discussion of heroin. It's just repeating that same idea.
But Rush Limbaugh, you know, innocent guy because he's OxyContin, right?
Because he did the right thing by going to the doctor, right? And that's a good thing, even though it might have had a negative consequence.
Another paradox is and this kind of AA discourse has become pervasive in both the professional side but also the pop culture side.
Yep.
You're forever fallen.
Yep.
That you are always an addict,
mm-hmm.
and you're sort of in temporary remission but mm-hmm. always in danger of relapse.
Yeah. So if you go back to sort of in the U.S., the invention of sort of the idea of the deviant and that the deviant's a particular kind of thing, I mean, this is what a famous sociologist, Kai Erickson, wrote in 1960-something, a book called Wayward Puritans, which was basically, his argument is that's where the idea emerged, that deviance is in you, and it can't be rooted out, but we're still going to try to do that. So that's this fundamental contradiction. And this is a huge contradiction in addiction discourse. It's a chronic relapsing condition. It's really hard to recover from. Once an addict, always an addict. But that doesn't mean we're going to stop trying to fix you. But embedded in our theory of how to fix you is that you can't ultimately be fixed. So what do you do with that? I mean, in some ways...
So it's a rationale for permanent intervention.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, you know, there's some people who have done research on what's called natural recovery. I mean, there's not a lot of funding for that because it's outside of this addiction framework. But their argument is that the people who do this work, that people who are best able to manage their drug use, right, it got to a level that they thought was problematic, then they're best able to manage it when they don't view themselves as an addict in that totalizing way. That once people start to take on that label, it's actually much harder because that rules their life in every realm, is that they're an addict and that they're fundamentally flawed and that they can't be fixed, but they should spend their whole life trying to fix themselves.
And in the AA model, like, you're constantly going to meetings, right?
Yeah.
It's like, so you're replacing one habitual behavior with another habitual behavior.
Yeah, you're constantly going to meetings, and, you know, and I must say, this is where I might get in trouble, but I'll just say it anyway, whatever. I have friends who are, you know, committed to the AA model, committed to the Al-Anon model, and so it's hard to have these conversations about it. I was kind of hoping when Philip Seymour Hoffman, so, you know, my work now is about how this stuff appears in media.
I want to get to the celebrity bit in a bit.
Yeah. But, you know, to me, people were like, oh, you know, he was in NA, and that was really important. But actually, the problem... And, you know, Whitney, Amy Winehouse is another example. She had been in some absence-based treatment program. The problem is, you know, the chance of overdose is extremely high once someone's been in an abstinence-based program, because those programs don't teach you how to use drugs safely. That's not on the table. And so often...
There's no such thing as using drugs safely.
No, there's no such thing. But often, people will go back and use them many times. And so what those things can kind of do is almost create this compulsion towards extremism, right? Because it's like, if I'm either addict, active addict, or addict in, you know, there's no sort of moderate, there's no rational sort of way of doing it. And I think that's really, I think fundamentally that's what we have to grapple with when we think about addiction in this country. And I was just in Portugal studying there. They have a model of drug decriminalization, which they instituted in 2001, and so they've decriminalized the personal possession of all drugs, all of them. They didn't make distinctions. And they just have a very different attitude about addiction, what it means, what to do about it.
I was in Lisbon at the end of last year and didn't see people lying about in the streets or anything. It seemed,
no. No, and someone had actually said to me, oh, you can see drugs everywhere. I went to the markets where you supposedly can buy them. I mean, sure, it was obvious that some people were buying some pot. But it's really, in some ways, I mean, their argument is we sensed we were going to have a problem, we sort of dealt with it head on, and it's just not the crisis that it is in other places. Partly that crisis, I mean, here, a crisis around drugs has to do with is the criminalization piece. And so I work on a syringe exchange in Rutland, Vermont, which is difficult to do because Rutland's very conservative. People think of Vermont as this progressive haven, and that's not true, actually, in a number of towns. And so we do this mobile syringe exchange. Most of the people I'm exchanging syringes with have had multiple stints in jail or prison. They're oftentimes, mandated to treatment. They have judges watching them. They have probation and parole officers. And so the problem is when this thing called recovery gets combined with all of that, it really makes it difficult for the person who has to navigate all these different systems.
And in the addiction discourse, we never talk about the fact that drugs are pleasurable.
Oh, I know. Well, that, to say that then it has to be, oh, but it's a pathological pleasure, right? It's very hard to just throw out that it's pleasurable. And I'm actually surprised, you know, so I teach young people, and I mean, they seem young to me. And I'm surprised it sort of, I use this book actually called Cigarettes Are Sublime by Richard
Klein. Oh, that's a great
Klein.
Book. I love yeah. that book. Yeah.
You know, and I think his discussion of cigarettes is really beautiful. It's like there's this beautiful thing about it and this like sublime pleasure in knowing that you're smoking this thing that could kill you, but there is pleasure there, and that's real. And the first couple times I taught that book, I just got a lot of pushback from students because they were sort of coming up of this like, cigarettes are the most evil thing in the world, and if you smoke them, it's only pain. There's no pleasure in something like that. And I think his book is really good for articulating that space of pleasure, even as he ended up writing that to quit smoking, right? Which is the nice part of that. It's like it's kind of his like goodbye letter to his love, cigarettes. And so pleasure is a difficult one. It's very hard to talk about pleasure. I remember having a conversation with one of these guys that Bruno, who we exchanged syringes with, he's actually on Suboxone, which is a methadone-like treatment for opiate addiction, and he likes to inject his Suboxone, which his treatment provider says he can't do, but he does it anyway. And he says to me, I guess I'm just addicted to the needle. That's what they say, I'm addicted to the needle. And I thought that was interesting because it just struck me as like he gets pleasure from injecting his synthetic opiate. There's pleasure in that ritual. There's pleasure in that. But he's not allowed to say that, so he has to say, well, I'm addicted to the needle, too. And so the pleasure, there's that sharp edge to it, which is, I think, the bigger thing, right, is everything we can potentially enjoy, sex, food, alcohol, we always have to watch ourselves. And that, I mean, that might be the sort of Protestant origins of thinking about the body as this site of constant work and discipline.
Wayward Puritans?
Yeah.
So now to the topic of your book, the drug court.
Mm-hmm.
This, I guess, started as one of these progressive-y, humane alternatives
sure.
to mass incarceration,
mm-hmm.
right? So tell us about the drug court, its origins and scope.
Yeah, so the drug court formed, I think the first one formed in 1986 in Florida. There's about, oh, I forget the numbers, maybe 2,300 in the U.S. I haven't really kept up with the numbers since the book came out. They're being it's a model that's being exported to the U.K., New Zealand, Australia. And the idea behind it is that it purports to be an alternative to incarceration. And so defendants who are identified as addicts go through a specialized court where their addiction becomes sort of the focus of reform. And they're mandated to drug treatment instead of prison. Although drug courts do use jail, but they call jail a treatment tool. So instead of jail being a punishment, jail is a kind of frequent or short jail stints become a sort of reminder of their commitment to sobriety. So if they're drug tested often, so if they have a positive drug test, they might be thrown in jail for a weekend to sort of remind them of their commitment to try to be sober.
There's a recurrent phrase in your book, dirty urine.
Yeah.
That'll get you to jail.
Really, there was an institutional problem, right? So the war on drugs, this is mid-1980s. You know, I mean, one of the big things about the war on drugs was it wasn't just kind of criminalizing more things, but it was the increasing use of prison as the punishment for these offenses. And that's really one of the major transformations. So you have prison overcrowding. I mean, you know, like, where are you going to put these bodies? And at the same time, you've got drug treatment, and drug treatment's sort of being starved, right? There's not a lot of money for drug treatment. Part of what I think is going on is you need to move these bodies to where they can go. So then what happens is you just relabel them addicts, and then you can move them into these drug treatment slots that are funded by the criminal justice system. And so this became this kind of shift that happened. Once you could label someone as an addict and you could get them into this drug court, then they were sort of treated through the drug court. Although some people end up failing out of the drug court and back in prison, because one of the things about drug courts, there are two models. There's a pre-plea and a post-plea model, and I think the majority are moving to post-plea, which means you plead guilty. So you have a certain prison sentence awaiting you if drug court doesn't work. It's not like you try drug court, if that doesn't work, then you go and deal with your charges. And so what, you know, the idea is that, well, that 7-year prison sentence is going to really help you take your sobriety seriously. So I think the huge misunderstanding about drug courts, or the incorrect way in which they advertise themselves, is as an alternative to incarceration, but they're not necessarily an alternative to incarceration. A number of people have done studies. The Drug Policy Alliance did a big study which drew on research from other people that shows that actually more people, it's a widening the net kind of thing. So arrests that wouldn't have really led to anything now lead to something because there's drug court and that's a place to put these people. Whereas before,
as in the case of so many of these pseudo-humane reforms, they really lubricate the machinery of punishment.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I was just talking to someone in Vermont who said that there's some push to spend $20 million to build a new women's prison. And she said, we've got to stop it. Because if you build a women's prison that can fit 300 people, you're going to put 300 people in there. And you're going to have to justify it. So you're going to, you know, if you build it, they will come kind of thing. And so that's the argument is that it's widening the net, that it's actually more an alternative to probation and parole rather than a you know, alternative to prison. You know, there are arguments that they're racially biased, that they sort of like skim off the top and take white defendants. I mean, I'm sympathetic to that argument, but I also don't believe that diversifying drug courts saves them. You know, I mean, that's the kind of tinkering, right? This is what you, diversifying the police force will make the police better. I don't think so.
You know, when you get to middle class, ordinary middle class psychotherapy, one of the mantras is that it only works if you want it to.
Mm-hmm.
People are being thrown into these coercive therapeutic situations. What therapeutic effect can it have if, you know, the alternative is, well, you're going to go to jail for 7 years?
I think that's fundamentally the question. That's what I asked a lot of people. That's what I was looking for in all the documents and other sort of things I read when I went to the drug court conferences, when I observed in drug courts. I looked at that contradiction. You know, the National Institute on Drug Abuse has come out, and then they're, you know, they've said drug treatment doesn't need to be voluntary for it to be effective. The danger of drug court, actually, that I sort of found was that they are arguing that coerced drug treatment is better than prison, but they're also arguing that coerced drug treatment is better than voluntary treatment, and that's a sort of step that they've made. And their argument is that coerced people stay in treatment longer, and then they think being in treatment longer means you have a more likely chance of recovering, which isn't true. There's actually no data on that. It's just that the more you're in treatment, equals better. That's the assumption, right? If some treatment
is the measure of success is how long you're in treatment. That's unusual for, you know, a disease. In a disease, you're supposed to be treated and better
and
out of treatment.
Yeah, and that you have some.
In this, being constantly in treatment is a sign of success.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
It makes no sense unless, right? It makes no sense. So if you push against it, it sort of falls apart. But that's the problem with addiction, is that you don't even know. I mean, the question is, what would success mean? And what would that look like? And how would you measure it? And how would you follow up? And
well, being clean and sober.
Being clean and sober, I guess. So then you repeatedly drug test people. And, I just was at, I went to the Probation and Parole Conference in New Orleans, and I went to the expo hall where all the companies that are selling GPS technology and alcohol monitoring technology.
Right. Now they have ankle braces that can tell whether you're drinking now.
Yeah, that's SCRAM. That's the Secure Continuous Remote Alcohol Monitoring System. But so what's happened is this whole burgeoning industry that's there to kind of monitor this sobriety long term, sort of, you know, through the what are called electronic tethers, right? The GPS anklet. There are all sorts of devices. So that what happens, I mean, and this in some ways comes back to what you said earlier. Once you call people addict, it's like they're never done. They're a project always sort of in the making. And so that the question is when do you like let them go? You know, when do you stop monitoring them? And I think one of the real dangers and one of the things that's happening, and I'm sort of witnessing this through looking at this project on electronic tethers, is these companies are coming in and saying, never let them go, because we're giving you the technology to follow them.
Well, it's like putting someone in a sex offender registry for life.
Yeah.
You never get off it.
No, you never get off of it. And when I was at this expo, they talked about sex offenders and addicts. I mean, those are, and of course, both of those, there's a similar ideology, which is they're sick and they can't be cured. And so for their good and for the good of society, you have to monitor them.
And there's always some nurse ratchet figure, like this combined punishing therapeutic figure.
Well, you know, this guy said something interesting to me at the expo, and I know I'm sort of veering away from drug courts, but the argument for electronic tethers and that sort of surveillance technology, and some sort of people who should know better have argued that, well, at least it gets them out of prison. But again, this isn't true. I think this is a net widening thing. And one guy at one of the companies, I think it was called Surveillance Tracking of People, LLC. I mean, they're not that imaginative with their names. Their names are what they are. And he said, you know, listen, these things are only good if you have a brick-and-mortar place to put people when they violate them. If you don't have a prison to put them in when they wander outside of the area that they're supposed to be in, or they drink or use drugs, then this technology doesn't matter. So this isn't going to get rid of prison. We need prison as the sort of brick-and-mortar, he kept saying, that place to put them when this technology shows that they've done something bad. And that's the point of the technology. That's what you want the technology to do. A number of people there said to me, it's great when it shows someone doing something wrong because it proves the technology works.
It's great for the company, but not necessarily for the wearer of the device.
Well, you know, they've lost their right to sort of freedom because of their bad behavior. I mean, that's what I heard over and over.
We sort of touched on this earlier, but this, what is precisely the bad behavior? I mean, mm-hmm. Or is it the addiction itself? I mean, if you drive drunk and get in an accident and hurt someone, that mm-hmm. is a crime, mm-hmm. clearly. If you steal to support a habit, mm-hmm. you know, that's clearly a crime. If mm-hmm. you are drunk and you beat up your spouse, you know, mm-hmm. those are crimes in themselves. But the act of taking a drug and getting high, mm-hmm. what precisely is the crime in that?
Well, you know, there's this idea that there is no victimless crime, right? That sort of, Jonathan Simon has written about this in a book whose name I can't remember right now, but sort of the emergence of the sort of the victim as a kind of a legitimate political identity, a sort of interest group that has to be attended to. And so I think this notion that there is no victimless crime. I mean, it is true that people in drug courts, a lot of them did things like steal stuff, robbed a store. You know, they did those kinds of things. And so the idea, what essentially they say is, oh, well, they did it to maintain their drug habit. But if you look at other countries, and this is where it does get controversial because people say, how in the world can you propose this? But, you know, there are places where, like, what if someone was a committed heroin user and they could go and get heroin and use it and then go and do whatever they need to do, right? So the problem is that even if they commit these things, which we call known crimes, right, and we might have an issue with them, the underlying issue is that if we really think drugs are motivating it, then why don't we just give them the drugs?
Because then everybody would do drugs, nobody would ever want to go to work again.
Well, I mean, maybe the problem's work, not drugs.
But you can't say that.
Oh, okay.
I was amazed to learn that there was, even as close as Vancouver, there are heroin lounges where people mm-hmm. can go and shoot up.
Yeah, safe injecting rooms. I mean, there are, you know, if you were serious about, I mean, this is interesting because one of my projects is looking a little bit at the moral panic over opiates. And I live in Rutland, which was featured in a New York Times article as the sort of epicenter, right? Drugs are everywhere, was what the journalist claimed. And people are saying Vermont's being so progressive around heroin, which just isn't true. If you look at these other places, I mean, you start to unpack, well, what's the problem? And that's sort of the question is, what is the problem with regular heroin use? And you start to see, you know, a lot of this stuff sort of starts to fall apart. So if the problem is that people have to spend a lot of time getting it, well, then just give it to them. If the problem is that they use dirty syringes and get sick, well, give them clean syringes. If the problem is that they overdose, well, then give them an environment to do it where they're not going to overdose. There are easier solutions, but the underlying thing, which comes back to, I think, the bigger issue that we've been talking about, which is we have a moral objection to people altering their consciousness. Although, of course, we have no problem with the pharmaceutical industry, right, which is
ethical drugs, as they say, yes. You know, and you look at these jurisdictions like Vancouver or Portugal mm-hmm. or the Scandinavian countries where they have these more humane harm reduction approaches to drugs. The streets are not full of people mm-hmm. collapsed in heroin stupors. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a problem, empirically speaking.
Yeah, it's not a problem. And this is where, you know, so I'm always interested in media depictions of drugs. I'm not really a fan of, like, drug shows because they're just, like, a pain to watch. And The Wire, I thought, was an interesting example. I watched some of it. I must admit, and I know hopefully no one hears this, I thought it was kind of boring. But there was the one episode.
I never got why people are obsessed with it either.
So. Yeah, I just sort of.
But we're it's a minority view.
Yeah. I'm just like, I just wasn't that into it. But there's this one episode where I guess they decide to zone off this area and people can do whatever drug, they can, like, commit whatever crimes they want in this area. And of course, what ends up happening is, like, people are passed out in the street and they're, like, having sex in the street and they're just like, it's like it all falls apart. And I think that's actually really damaging because shows like that show that, because that plays into our fantasy of what we think is going to happen. But, you know, lots of people use drugs now anyway. So it's not as if prohibition has somehow kept us safe. And in fact, you know, you could argue that a system of legalization and some kind of control keeps people a lot safer than what we have now.
I'm speaking with the sociologist Rebecca Tiger, author of Judging Addicts, from NYU Press.
I love those stories you occasionally read of where they measure the quantities of drugs in sewage systems.
Oh, really?
And find that,
oh, that's,
you know, like, the usage is enormous, and only a small portion of the people who are using get busted.
Yeah.
And the people who get busted, obviously, are unfavored demographic groups,
yeah,
generally. But, you know, it is, we can't admit to ourselves how widespread the usage is.
Oh, it's really widespread. I don't know what we think we're fighting. And, you know, there are people, you know, it's interesting to me sort of to watch, like, what's happening with the drug policy reform movement. And, you know, so you have the sort of, let's legalize marijuana. I think the strategy there has been, let's try to say that marijuana is different than these other things, right? I mean, you know, so marijuana is not heroin, and it's better for you than alcohol, right? There's this attempt to sort of distinguish it as something that's, like, benign. And, you know, I'm supportive of whatever efforts that reduce criminalization. I think at the same time, I mean, I'm sort of interested about how this panic over heroin emerges as we have this kind of liberalizing attitudes towards marijuana. So it's almost like we're firming up that heroin is bad. We've got to do something about it, even as we sort of shift our attitudes about this other kind of thing.
Well, it's another one of these humane reforms that actually greases the punishment machine.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's some sort of Protestant ethic underlying this,
yeah.
The notion that pleasure itself is somehow threatening and problematic.
I think you're right. Pleasure is threatening, and there's also the idea that, so the people I interviewed, you know, one quote was force is the best medicine. The other one was that this is enlightened coercion, because I would say, well, how is this different than earlier attempts to coerce people? Well, this is enlightened coercion. We're using the science to do it right. There's the first strand of sort of, you know, this Protestant thing like fit body. If you look a certain way, that says that you're actually good inside in some sense, right? Even though we say it's secular, there is a kind of, you know, like, oh, you're a really good person if you look like you're disciplined. But it's not just that. It's also forcing the discipline on other people. And that's really the key here is forcing them. And that is that to me is the sort of, that's the liberal impulse, right? It's for your own good.
Yeah, I kept thinking of this old David Bowie lyric, we'll force you to be free.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the construction of the addict is that he or she is unhappy,
yeah,
and unfree. And we're going to use the coercive machinery of the state, aided by the therapeutic,
mm-hmm,
machinery,
yeah,
to make you happy and free.
To make you free. But the way you exhibit your freedom is to control your impulse to do what you want, which is to use the drug. So freedom, there's some historian of this who's called it the dilemmas of freedom. I mean, you're free, but the way you know you're free is that you're exercising control of the part of you that really wants to be free. And so it's a very interesting notion of freedom. What does it mean to be free? Well, free is that you control yourself and you're able to do it, and that the happiness and pleasure is supposed to derive from that control.
Submit to God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, in some ways, we're not that far off, right? I mean, that's essentially, those are the origins of it, and we haven't gotten that far from it.
A lot of our understanding of drugs and a lot of our policy seems to be driven,
mm-hmm,
by celebrity drug cases.
Yes.
I mean, you know, we go back to the crack mania, the Len Bias,
yes,
death was,
yeah,
what contributed to that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're constantly hearing, you know, ODs. The Lindsay Lohan story has been going on for, what, 10
yeah,
years of,
yeah,
of Lindsay Lohan. What is the role of the celebrity in constructing our understanding of addiction?
Yeah, I mean, the argument I make, I'm working on a book called Rock Bottom now, and I published about Lindsay Lohan and I did a comparison of Whitney Houston and Lance Armstrong. Performance-enhancing drugs are sort of interesting when they're thrown into the mix. I mean, my argument is that what this media does is keep visible certain dominant ways of thinking about addiction, and especially the kind of media, the kind of interaction that's available through things like celebrity gossip blogs. So I've written an article about Perez Hilton's coverage of Lindsay Lohan, and Perez Hilton is a blogger who has potentially about 12 million unique viewers a month, and his blog is interactive, and that's what's really important about the sort of new media celebrity gossip blogs, so that he posts a story and readers can have conversations with Perez Hilton and each other. And what my argument is that rather than punishment being hidden, and that's what some people have said, well, you know, people don't object to how we punish because they don't see it. My argument is that's not true. Actually, we see it all the time. And we see it in unlikely places. And one of those places has to do with celebrity. And so what happens, I noticed I looked at a lot of the coverage of Lindsay Lohan. So a couple years ago, she was sentenced for a probation violation by a judge. And the judge said, you are sick. So I'm going to sentence you to 90 days in jail, followed by 90 days in drug treatment, which was a really interesting statement to make. You're sick, so I'm going to put you in jail, and then I'm going to put you in treatment. And the responses of the readers were very, very interesting, because most of them sort of agreed that addicts are sick and that judges should be overseeing their treatment and that they need jail as part of their effort to get better. And so what I've really started to notice on these blogs and through celebrity is just how punitive we are. And I know some people...
Well, people take pleasure in the punitiveness.
They take pleasure in the punitiveness.
I feel a strange sympathy for poor Lindsay Lohan. People take enormous pleasure in humiliating her and mocking her.
Yeah, and you know, so people will say to me, well, one, that's just Lindsay Lohan. Or they'll say, well, people who comment on blogs, you have to dismiss them. I don't think actually that's true, that we should dismiss them. I think that they're offering a really good window into how people think about these things. But there's a great book that came out recently called Inferno by a law scholar. Maybe his last name's Ferguson. I mean, and he talks about the pleasure we get in punishment. If we're going to address this mess that we're in the U.S. And, I mean, you have to say we're in a mess. We're at 7-point-something million people under some form of supervision. We have to sort of look at the pleasure we get in punishing. And it's clearly there. And it's clearly there in odd instances. So that when people feel that they're wrong, you know, the impulse to sort of lock Wall Street CEOs up for life in prison still affirms prison as something that we believe in. We just want to make sure the right people get in prison, not the wrong ones. And so there is pleasure in our punitive impulse, even if I can sympathize with where that impulse comes from. And so my argument is celebrity sort of churns this up and keeps it visible so that addiction, people talk about it a lot because it's offered to us sometimes several times a day on the blogs.
It's almost as if we're back where we started in some sense, like putting someone in the stocks in the village square as an act of public humiliation.
Mm-hmm.
Now we do it in a very highly mediatized way, but a lot of the underlying psychodynamics seem very similar.
I think they're very similar, and that's why I think, you know, so I teach Intro to Sociology, and we read Marx, Weber, Durkheim, and we go through the sort of classics, and people have argued sort of that the Durkheim approach to punishment, the idea that things are visible and that the collective consciousness is sort of rallied because of that's not really what's happened, that what we have in punishment is a bureaucratized, rationalized, hidden system. But I just don't think that's true. I think what we do have this rationalized, in quotes, system, right, that's heavily bureaucratized and professionalized. But then there's the public reaffirmation of it. I mean, I would argue needs to happen for the system to maintain its legitimacy. So no one says, I mean, this is amazing to me that I look through all this coverage of Lindsay Lohan, and no one says, why is a judge overseeing her treatment? Why is someone for a probation violation being thrown in jail for 90 days and drug treatment for 90 days? I think another good example is Chris Brown, a musician and a sort of Rihanna fame. I mean, he was recently thrown in jail because he violated the conditions of his probation, which was to be in an anger management program. And so he was coerced into an anger management program. And what he did at that anger management program was display anger, and he got kicked out. And because he got kicked out, he got thrown in jail. Justin Bieber actually got mandated to anger management, and people on the blogs loved it. Throw his ass in jail. Keep him there. I mean, it's amazing when you sort of see this start to emerge, this kind of public reaffirmation of jail and prison. And so I sort of get discouraged, I guess, when I see that, because I think even though there have been really excellent books, Michelle Alexander's book is the sort of most recent example of something, you know, The New Jim Crow, that's gotten a lot of attention. Lots of people have read that. Lots of people are talking about it. But I think there's actually a really punitive element. And I don't think it's a group that's easy for us to dismiss. Oh, those are just wacko right-wingers. I don't think that's the case. I think it's kind of widespread, a faith in punishment.
That was Rebecca Tiger, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Middlebury, author of Judging Addicts.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.